Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Flywheel, your number one source for everything crypto, DeFi, and all that's in between. If you want to know what's going on, you've come to the right place. This is DeFi Dave, here Solo Dolo, and I'm here to help you harness the power of the flywheel. And this time around, we go to the world of Solana. We have on Jordan Prince. For those who are unfamiliar, he is co-founder of Metaplex, co-founder of BNJ Studios, which is incubated projects such as the Cube Exchange and Elements. He is an early Solana core, Solana Labs dev who helped him and his partner, Bartosz. They actually helped write a lot of early Solana code, a lot of which is still being used to this day. And he gave us a lot of great insight on kind of how he got into crypto, which was a lot later than most, you know, kind of his journey, how they started the Solana hacker houses. And also we talk about dApps and their positives and negatives. So this is a really good episode. We're going to get right into it. But before we did, do make sure you go ahead, hit that bell button, subscribe. If you're watching this on YouTube, leave us a comment. Let us know what you think. Give us a like. Goes a long way. Make sure you follow us on all of our socials on Twitter, TikTok, and Telegram at Flywheel DeFi. You can follow me on Twitter at DeFiDay22. And let's get the flywheel spinning. All right, everybody. Welcome back to Flywheel. I'm your host, DeFi Dave. Here doing this one solo dolo, and this time around we go to Solana land. Again, we've done it a few times before, but this time around we have on a Solana OG, someone that was an engineer early on at Solana Labs and went on to be the co-founder of both Metaplex, which is the NFT standard of Solana, as well as BNJ Studios, which is incubating a number of cool projects such as Cube Exchange, Elements. We're going to get into all that on the show, but we have on Mr. Jordan Prince. Jordan, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and I wanted to get you on the show because we met a week and a half ago when I was in Chicago, maybe 2 weeks ago now, and I really enjoyed your insights on Solana, comparing it to Ethereum, where you see Solana going. It's something I don't really hear a lot on the timeline or hear a lot in my daily conversation since I'm mostly in Ethereum land, so it's always good to hear something outside the box in that regard. But before we get into all those thoughts, for the listeners who may not know who you are, can you give a little bit of your background and how you got into crypto?
Yeah. I'm a bit unusual. I actually had my first crypto transaction, I think it had to have been in December of 2020. Up till that point, I actually had considered crypto of all kinds to be a scam. And we're even talking like Bitcoin, like the most bare bones, like honest crypto, Bitcoin, to be a scam. And I didn't think much of it. I didn't think highly of it. I didn't like where I was at in my life. I was working at Citadel. I've been working there for a year and a half. And I wanted a change, and my best friend at the time, he was working as a contractor for Solana, and he recommended that I interview for a job there. I was like, oh, crypto, like really crypto? And he was like, it's actually, the work is really like it's as difficult and engaging as the stuff you're doing at Citadel, but the people are significantly cooler. so you should try it out. And so I was like, I decided I'd give it a shot, not really necessarily because of crypto innately calling out to me like as a true believer, but because I actually wanted to work with people that I really liked and that the work itself was naturally engaging. I like working on winning teams and working on winning products. For me, it was about the product. His pitch was like, hey, Solana is going to kill this other thing called Ethereum, and it's going to, it's going to win in the marketplace. And like, regardless of what you think about crypto, there is still a marketplace and there are still customers. I was like, okay, fine. So I had to spend like 2 weeks sort of researching crypto, to learn about crypto, to do the homework I had been given, which was kind of building the front end for a margin trading platform. They didn't necessarily expect me to build a lot of smart contract innards yet for the interview, but they did expect me to integrate the smart contract that had already been existing. So I had to learn how Solana worked. I had to learn how the concept of what a transaction was. I had to learn, how atomicity worked in the Solana system. And I had to, most importantly of all, I had to do a transaction. I had to do a real honest to God transaction on the blockchain, right? So like, I had to use the product. And so I actually, I got on Coinbase. You know, I put $200 on there. And first thing I did was I thought, well, if I'm going to be using Solana, I should also use their competitor. And I bought a Ledger and I sent $100 from of USDC from Ethereum, like the Ethereum on Coinbase to the my Ethereum wallet on the Ledger. And this took me a while to figure out. Like, I was a senior engineer who had been working for, I think, 10 years at that time. Took me probably, 2 hours to sort of get all this right, like with research and understanding to figure out how not to lose $100. And after, I think, 8 minutes or so, it shows up on my ledger. I'm like, okay, great. Let's send my money back. And what I didn't quite understand at the time was I think Coinbase covered the fee.
Yeah.
But I wanted to send it back. And they were like, hey, that's great. You'll get $60 back when it lands on the Coinbase side, because the other $40 are going to be eaten up by the fee of sending the transaction on Ethereum. And I remember being hit by this white hot blinding anger. And I was like, and I remember asking my friend, I was like, is this all that there is? Is this Ethereum thing? This is what's being used primarily right now for all of decentralized finance. Like, there's Bitcoin, which is kind of a store of value. No one's using it for money. Like, unit of account, or it's a money is a unit of account, unit of exchange, and a store of value. And Bitcoin can't be used for a unit of account because it fluctuates in value too much. Can't be used as a unit of exchange because it costs too much. But it can be used as a store of value. But Ethereum could, in theory, as a system, be used for all three. But because it costs so much for transactions, it's also effectively hobbled, right? I'm like, is this what we have, right? Is this what the world is using right now? My friend was like, "Yeah, this is Ethereum. This is the greatest, the best thing that the world has right now." And he was like, "Try it with Solana." So I tried it with Solana. It took less than a minute for the transaction to go across. And when I sent it back, I pretty much got the whole $100 back. Like, I actually didn't notice that. I didn't know that there were transaction fees for the first 2 weeks I was pulling with Solana, because the transaction fees were so freaking low. And that's when I knew. I was like, this isn't just like a competitor to Ethereum. It's like, it could potentially be the end of Ethereum. Yeah. And people, and I went on, and I wasn't even on Twitter at that point in time, because I thought Twitter was stupid. Cause at my age, I didn't need to use Twitter. I didn't use any social media. I worked at Citadel. Right. But I learned that this is where people discuss this stuff. So I signed in there and I tried to figure out, like, why do they care about Ethereum so much versus Solana? This seems like an obvious, this seems obvious to me. And it seemed like there was a lot of shit about, decentralization. Solana at that time was more central. It's not more centralized now, but at the time it was more centralized than Ethereum. And people cared a lot about this. It was like a religious thing. Like, this idea of decentralization. But for me, as sort of a new user who was used to using like Apple products and Google products, I was like, you guys are kind of missing the boat here. Like, if you're trying to get actual retail users, like, I care about losing $40 when I send $100. And so I saw potential. I was like, Solana may not be perfect yet, but it's going to get perfect really fast. And it's going to outpace everything. And centralization is a problem that can be solved. And indeed, it was ultimately solved. Every day it gets more and more decentralized. And so that was my prediction. I was like, it may not be as decentralized now, but, you keep adding validators, you keep getting better, you keep figuring out better ways to do things. Like, there are people smarter than you working on this problem. So that first 2 weeks, it was like getting hit by a tidal wave of information. And I was sort of hooked on the whole process. And I interviewed like hell and I got the job, and I was sort of hooked, and I became a crypto person. But I'm a weird kind of crypto person, because I'm not a power user. Like, I don't margin trade. I'm not constantly trying to, take out like 50% LTV loans on my assets to then go put it into other staking products to, you know, trade again and again and again in a loop de loop. I just stake my stuff. Like mm-hmm. I'm kind of a crypto maxi that's also a retail user. And that's how I've always approached it. I always try to approach the crypto world as if, you know, I were my own father or, you know, my grandmother or my wife or someone that, you know, would be using this to better their own lives, but in a way that is not complex.
Yeah.
And that's how I got into it. And I got into it 3 years ago. So that's how I got into crypto. It was 3 years ago because I got into it very late relative to a lot of the other people. I tried to keep the fact that I'm a newbie, like in the front and center of my mind. Like whenever I see something that's like stupidly complex,
yeah,
I'm like, this is never going to fly in the real world. Like no one's going to care about this, whatever it may be. But when I see something like beautifully simple, I think this has a chance. Like a great example of something that I think is going to fly, the Jambo phone. I'm not sure if you're aware of it.
Yeah. I actually met the founders last year in Singapore.
Yeah, I've met them too. They have a $100 smartphone. It looks beautiful. Basically, it's like a cheap Android phone. And I don't mean that derogatorily. It's not cheap in like a bad way. It's an inexpensive Android phone that almost anyone can afford. And it's got a built-in wallet. And you can run Solana, and I think they also have Aptos support now too. You know, out of the box, it isn't huge. Like if you use it, it's not huge on trying to explain crypto to you or putting crypto in your face. It's just kind of, it's a phone.
Yeah.
And if you want to use the crypto aspects to it, you can, but like its user experience is more focused on being a phone first. Mm-hmm. And integrating crypto in a seamless way that makes it feel more like Apple Pay. And I think that's the way to do things, you know, being cheap, effective, and out of the way. And so like when I see crypto products that are like that, I really love those things.
So basically, you're a doubter at first. And mm-hmm. probably like one of my favorite quotes is from Terence McKenna when he quoted the Bible saying like, oh, Thomas the doubter, he was the one that was the doubter that like, oh, Jesus was resurrected. But it's always the doubters that become the biggest believers at the end of the day.
Yes.
So you're a doubter yeah. first. And then right. when you actually went to try, do your research and actually try to use crypto for the first time, coming from your perspective of like, okay, like I want something that's easy to use, that's like something that's just common sense to the average user, which is a lot different than a lot of people who came into crypto first, who are those fervent believers that are dogmatic and care, not dogmatic in a bad way, but they just care about decentralization.
I think it's like, I respect the people that care about these things. I think they have a place in the world of crypto. Like, just like you always need someone that is reading. We actually have a special, so in Israel, there is a special place for people that study the Talmud. They actually get money from the government to study the Talmud.
Yeah.
So that they can keep the memory of the religion alive to teach others, right? Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to decentralization and other tenets of the faith of crypto, I think it's important that you have people that care about it to remind people like me that are just trying to build a good user experience for people. Like, hey, if you go too far in one direction, you're going to end up with, you know, Chase Bank.
Yeah.
You know, so it's important, but like at the same time, there's always a compromise to be had. I think Solana and I think a lot of the newer blockchains are hitting that compromise nicely. The other problem to remember is like Ethereum was built earlier. So choices mm-hmm. were made earlier. And when you make earlier choices, you don't have the benefit of hindsight. And as an engineer, once you make certain choices, you're stuck with them.
Yeah.
So I don't want this to come off as like, I am trying to crap on Ethereum. They were there first. Like, you know, they made choices. They had to figure things out. Like, it's not like Ethereum engineers are worse than Solana engineers. Actually, the Solana engineers are standing on the shoulders of Ethereum engineers. And it's just, you know, it's really the march of progress, right? So in one mm-hmm. sense, it's a competition of marketplaces, but in another sense, it's the march of progress really kind of in a way like scientists working to discover the best way to do a thing. And that thing is like efficient transfer, more efficient transfers of wealth and better rules around monetary transactions without the friction of middlemen and governments getting in the way to try to steal wealth through corruption and regulation that is unnecessary versus regulation yeah. that is necessary.
Speaking of hindsight with Ethereum, when it decided to go the L2 path, I think this is a great example.
It is a great example, yeah.
Because back then, I don't think people could predict how much not only liquidity would be fractured, but also user experience would be fractured, mind share and attention that would be fractured. Because back in 2020, everybody was united on Ethereum, and Ethereum was probably at its strongest point. Even it may have not been at its all-time high, but attention, mind share, Ethereum was at its strongest point. And people like myself who came in the class of 2017, I think we all followed a similar path where, like, for me, I was like, oh, more of a BTC person, because that's what you're just told. And then when you experience sexes for like 3-4 years and you're like, oh, this stuff kind of sucks. I actually like was at my earlier job, I was in charge of listings for the token I worked at, and trying to deal with like listings on all these centralized exchanges was an absolute nightmare. Going through the whole application process, negotiating, a lot of the exchanges were not in good faith. So then when a DeFi actually came along and was one of the first things you could actually do on chain on a wide scale, and you saw Uniswap, you're like, oh my God, you have this like aha moment. And then between that and the tenets of decentralization that Bitcoin started, Ethereum, to their best of their ability, tries to bring along, you're like, you kind of just end up becoming an ETH maxi. At least that's what happened to me personally for a while. And so I feel like a lot of people in my class and cohort, especially on Twitter, and you kind of see this now, they became ETH aligned or ETH maxis in a sense. And now what's interesting to see is that to be completely fractured, completely smashed with a hammer, because you see like everything fractured. So like, I guess like, what are your thoughts on like the L2 roadmap of Ethereum from your angle? Like, do you think it's good for Ethereum, bad for Ethereum? Do you think there should be more focus on the L1?
Yeah, look, I'm not an expert on L2s by any means, right? I come from an L1 that's so fast that it doesn't necessarily need them all the time. What I've noticed from observing from afar, and again, this is coming from not an expert, so I don't want to like, I know I'm going to get a lot of slings and arrows for this analysis, so that's why I'm trying to couch it with some like, you know, being nice. I think L2s have a habit of ring fencing value, right? Like I think what people want when they make an L2 is they want to separate off a pool of data and compute. Like as an engineer, they're like, God damn it, I can't get my transactions to run and storing data is too expensive. I want my own servers, essentially. Like what they want is AWS. They want to like run their own EC2 cluster. And that's what, kind of what they're aiming for, right? That's what they want. And in practice, they get that. But what they forget is that part of the data they're cutting off of the main, say, branch or trunk of the data that is Ethereum is the data that represents the tokens, because tokens are just data too. But this is a very special subset of data that they've cut off. This is data representing actual monetary value. And the way that they do this is they say, hey, you know, if you want to use my little pool of compute, you got to take your tokens and log them in my multisig. And by the way, it's a whole separate conversation. Trust me, it's fine. My multisig. And then I'll mint you some tokens in my little separate pool of compute and data. And then you can use my little separate pool over here. And then we're all fine and dandy. But what's happened in practice is that, like you said, you've now fractured the liquidity. And when you fracture the liquidity, you get even more perfidious things besides Uniswap now can't easily do trading without using a bridge or something. You now have a fracturing of communities and of people doing development and of people deploying smart contracts. You get a fracturing all the way down the very center of the whole ecosystem, splits in two. And then you have to multiply that by N for each layer two. But the thing is, there's a huge incentive to do it because every set of engineers that desires to do this, they become either 100 millionaires, centimillionaires is what they're called, or they become billionaires. Huge incentive to do this because each time someone does this, they get to launch a token. And each time they launch a token, they make tons of money. And plus they get to silo off more value. So each one is basically launching a parasite attack on the Ethereum mainnet and launching their own token as well, bringing in more VC dollars, keeping the thing going. You know, but ultimately what they probably should have done, I think the original intention was great, right? Like, the problem is the Ethereum design, it's not parallelized. You know, it can't run as fast. You know, the way that they design data structures in an Ethereum contract is kind of weird. You know, you have this main state tree that can't be edited simultaneously, whereas the Solana account structure mechanism where each account is separate so you can write to them each separately is much better. So because you have this decision that was made years ago and it's bad, you have to deal with it. Ethereum is just fucking slow. The way that they dealt with it was they were like, okay, we're going to make L2s so people can kind of have their own little private pools instead of one big public pool that everyone swims in. That's fine. It's great. The problem is they need to stop trying to fragment the liquidity. The way that you do that is you don't fragment off the value. You just fragment off the actual data and the actual compute. So how you do that, I think, is delicate. I think there are different ways to do that. But I think you've got to stop. There are ways to do an L2, I think, where you don't say, hey, send me your tokens. you just say like, hey, we're going to come up with ways that you can you basically deploy your contract to our L2 and all of the data related to, like, let's say your game and all the fake little tokens that don't matter related to your game are stored on that L2. And, you know, we will have a contract on the L1 that has some permissions over some tokens that you put in an escrow, but those escrow tokens don't actually really replicate onto the L2. And really they stay on the L1. And so there's some loose association between the actual L1 value and the L2, but the L2 never actually replicates the L1 value. It just has some data and has some logic. It becomes like a thinking layer, mm-hmm. and it propagates back logic and data. And so the bridge that exists between the L2 and the L1 becomes a bus for data. You know, so maybe the game contract that exists there would, you know, basically have a little bus that says like, hey, you know, move tokens around because like this person lost a sword and this person gained a sword or something like that. But the actual tokens remain on the L1. They don't get stuck in a giant, you know, multi-sig, and that would maybe allow, you know, contracts like Uniswap to continue to interact with those tokens and have them on order books with proper permissions. Like, I am not smart enough to figure this out.
Yeah.
Entirely. I'm just thinking like there are probably ways to make an L2 that don't involve moving the money. Like mm-hmm. that's sort of the key thing. If the money doesn't move, the communities don't move. That's that's my central thesis that I guess I'm getting at. Money doesn't move, community doesn't move, developers don't move, and developers start treating the L2s not as L2s, but more like extensions. They're like, this is a place where I compute, where I store data. But I still think of Ethereum as the place of value. Mm-hmm. And you kind of see it, I think you see, you're gonna see more of this in the Solana world than you'll see this in the Ethereum world, because it didn't happen with the L2s there. But like, yeah. I think with the Solana world, as Solana starts launching its own expansion projects, because they will exist by necessity, I suspect that they won't have the same fracturing because Solana will just, it's naturally going to be easier to keep the, you know,
the value on the L1.
Yeah. Cause it's just, I think it's just easier to, I don't know, do a data bus with Solana. But maybe that could be my bias because I just understand it better. But anyways, so I'm literally talked out of my ass for 10 minutes. So I could be completely wrong here. But that's like,
no that
that's
makes
what I
want
to see. That's how I think you should fix it.
Basically, where there's value, there is attention always. And when you have the value living on a separate chain, basically, quote unquote, on a roll up, it fragments the attention. But if you had it on the L1, no way to bust. I get it.
But this is all if you actually want to fix this problem. Maybe you don't. Maybe you actually want this fragmentation. I don't know. Maybe there's a positive to it that we haven't considered.
Show me an incentive and I'll show you an outcome, and look at all these raises, for the roll-ups. Like, I don't see it stopping anytime soon.
What if we didn't have these L2s? Would we have as much money pumping into the Ethereum ecosystem via VCs? Would we have as much innovation? Maybe not. So maybe you do want it.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, and it's hard to say like what would happen in a what-if scenario. But I wanted to talk about what we talked about when I first met you, which was like Solana. Solana could overtake. And your thesis is like Solana can overtake Ethereum. I'm just like wondering, like how has Solana evolved since 2020 till now, and like what do you think it will take for like a flippening to happen, quote unquote? Do you think that's even possible? I hate saying the flipping word because I feel like every time I say that's always marks the top of like said asset. Whenever it was like, oh, ETH's gonna flip in, literally that ends. And so like same, I saw it with Solana too.
I think the pie is just growing. Mm-hmm. For everybody, including even Ethereum. I think things are just growing at different rates, slightly. I think what really drives sort of adoption of the different chains is really where the developers go. Because, you know, the products that get built are determined by what chains developers choose to use. And I think that building on Solana is, frankly, easier and more economical than Ethereum. Because just think about it. Like we just talked about this whole L2 thing. Like when I first arrived, there were like a tenth of the number of L2s that there are today. But when I looked into that whole ecosystem to try to understand what an L2 even was, I was so confused. I was like, wait, am I writing the smart contract for Ethereum or am I writing it for like, let's say Optimism. I don't even know if it was around back then. But it was confusing to me because then I had to understand like, okay, so as a new developer, I deploy the Optimism and then there has to be like a fraud proof thing. I'm not sure if Optimism uses fraud proofs or not. Like that's a whole different thing. And then like it takes like potentially it goes down there within a few hours. And so there's like really two sources of truth. There's the Optimism one and then there's the Ethereum version of the truth. But then also 3 days from now, a fraud proof could be deployed that, you know, makes it roll back. And by the way, that could happen for program deploys as well. And I think I'm talking about Polygon now. So each one of these layer twos has its own set of rules that you have to learn about, you know, aside from the mainnet. And they have slightly different, like, you know, ways of doing things. And like, so as like an engineer, it's like you have to learn so much infrastructure just to deploy a goddamn smart contract. It's like, why would I even try? And then if you make a mistake, like I heard back in the day, like I remember in 2021, I was looking at the cost to deploy a smart contract on Ethereum. It was like thousands of dollars. You know, and it's like the cost of failure is high. Solana used to cost a lot to deploy a smart contract on a mainnet because you couldn't redeploy the same contract, like the same address, but they fixed that. So now it's pretty cheap to deploy a smart contract to Solana, and you don't have to think about any layer twos. Like there is no layer two. There's just the freaking mainnet, and you don't have to understand how a validator works, really. You don't have to understand, you know, anything. There's no such thing as like a fraud proof. Like if you don't want to worry about like Merkle trees, you don't have to worry about Merkle trees. You can make up your own data structures. You know, and back in the day, there was no such thing as Anchor. I had to write my own serializer, deserializer, which sucked, but now there is Anchor. So like the developer ecosystem, even back then, it was crappy, but it was still so much easier than Ethereum with all of its tooling. Now there's all this tooling on top and all these videos and examples, and you can go to the hacker houses, and the Solana Foundation makes so much amazing documentation. Plus, there's these super team people that are like literally in every country willing to help you. Like if I am an engineer and I choose Ethereum over Solana, like I am either blind or biased. And so that's the thing that's working against Ethereum right now is really that Solana has out-learned them. Like, as you could say, like they're out-teaching. And we could get into why Solana is better from an engineering standpoint, but really the thing you should be worried about is that Solana is better at teaching. And then you create more products because you have more engineers, and then more people are using those products and they're cheaper to use, and it just propagates and propagates and propagates.
It's a flywheel.
Yeah, it's a flywheel. It's a flywheel of engineering. I mean, you could argue this is why, like, you know, America, you know, took over the world in the last century was because of the education system. I mean, the last 20 years notwithstanding. I'm talking about the previous century.
Speaking of education, one of the initiatives you led early on were the hacker houses, I believe. So where did the idea of hacker houses came from, and how did that start, and what are some hacker house success stories?
So it started with my friend Bartosz and I. We were the original genesis of the Chicago office of Solana Labs or Foundation. I'm not sure which it was, but they rented an office for us in the Hoxton Hotel in Fulton West Market. But it was way bigger than it needed to be. So Bartosz would occasionally reach out to teams on Twitter and invite them to come sit with us for a week. So like Drift Protocol came in to visit, Hero Labs, I think, was in Chicago, and they were sitting, I think, somewhere else, and they came to visit, and they actually stuck around. I'm maybe misremembering some teams here, but the different teams came at different points. So it wasn't really like a mobile phenomenon. And then the 2021 Lisbon breakpoint came up, and I had this idea that we should sort of do a pop-up version of this. And I tweeted that I would like to do this pop-up version of it and that I was looking for sponsors. And I calculated that I needed about $60,000 to do it. Essentially, it was a personal thing. I basically tweeted that I was doing this by myself, because it wasn't a Solana thing at that point. They had all their programming figured out, and I did this like a week beforehand, so it kind of wasn't fair to just spring this on anyone. But I was surprised to find that a lot of people were interested in hanging out somewhere. So a bunch of different companies reached out, including Metaplex, these jungle cat guys who I'd helped launch an NFT project for, and the Boring Protocol, which are these router people, and some other teams, like a lot of different people that aren't around anymore. But I collected $60,000, which was amazing, because I did not have a lot of money then. And I collected the money. And then what was amazing was this guy Chico reached out to me. He lived in Lisbon. And he was like, yo, like, you're never going to get this figured out because you don't live here. Like, you need my help. And I trusted him. And he actually found this horse stable. Like, it used to be like a royalties horse stable next to the hotel where I was staying, and he rented it out. And then by the time I arrived, he had rented like the computer screens and the tables and like the coffee and put it in there. And if you look at the old pictures of the first hacker house, it was very shitty. It was basically like just tables and computer screens and coffee and Chico and me, just like hoping people would show up. And that was pretty much the first hacker house. And like the first few days, it was just the two of us just sort of keeping shit alive. And it turned into some like weird overnight success because a lot of people started to show up. And then around the third day, Bartosz was finally done with all the talks he had to give, and he was able to start, pitching in, with hours. And so he started doing like, I'd say half time with me. And then by the end of the 5 days, it was kind of such a weird phenomenon that, Raj and Toli actually talked about it at the end of the, what do you call it? The end of the
breakpoint,
the event. Yeah. End of breakpoint. It was viewed as like a one-off. Bartosz and I, after that, we sat down and we talked, and we decided to throw one more. So together we personally, like the two of us now, went on Twitter and we said, hey, we're going to throw another one, this time in Miami. And this was not Solana Miami. This was the first Miami. It was just the Miami Hacker House.
I remember.
It was like Fun Dimension. We just went and got like this fucking.
This was during peak Miami. This was like when everybody was like moving there, like at the end of COVID. Around was showing it. There was like, I remember I was there. It was like Miami Hack Week, Miami Tech Month, Miami Crypto. It was,
it was the height of the craziness. But, it was the same week that FTX was having this like, banger. And
I was at the bank.
So we strategically positioned our event across the street from their banger. It was at this place called Fun Dimension, which was like a Chuck E. Cheese's. And we rented the whole place out. We raised $80,000 for this. And so what we would do is we would hack during the day, and it was just as grungy as it was the first time. There was no special lighting, no magic to it. There was food this time. We had like, you know, carnival
stepping
food.
Up there.
Yeah, stepping up the game. And it still was not Solana, official Solana. It was just Bartosz and I. It was a B&J event, like, you know, because like, you know, I think it was still, I think, risky for for an organization to back an event like this, because it was just, it wasn't clear what it was or how it was connected. And we were doing U.S. events, like this was a U.S.-based event. So, you know, it needed to be figured out. But, you know, we were running this experiment. We were technically on vacation, and it was, you know, it went well. At night, we would all go over to the FTX event, and people basically got like a free party, you know, that we didn't have to throw, but, you know, we got to drink the booze and, you know, like not have to pay for it. It was great. Cause the FTX guys would just see that we were rolling over and they would just let us in, and it was great. And I enjoyed that a lot. It was a good time. And then the third and final, I guess you call it like unofficial hacker house, the last B&J hacker house, was the Chicago hacker house, which was actually, we teamed up with Jump, and Jump funded it. And that was the first one that I would say was truly official looking. And that we worked with Limitless Events, which is this events company out of Chicago. And we hosted it in this place called The Pit, which is sort of this, it's this area that Jump has in their trading building. That's it's like an event area. And Limitless did this amazing job sort of making it look green and having this like under lighting. And it looked very matrixy. And it was the first hacker house that I felt looked like official, like kind of like really professionally done. And it had like, it went from having like 50 people to like 200 people, 250 people. And we had like an actual event sign up booth and some other stuff, but it still was not Solana. But that was the first time actually that Solana Foundation sent along Ellie Plattis, who is the current events coordinator for Solana. I think she works for Foundation. Yeah, she works for Foundation. You know, we introduced her to the hacker houses. We had done her, she was going to take over from us, the hacker houses. She got to see that one. And that informed her, you know, taking over the hacker houses. So every hacker house after that one, she threw. And so like, you know, she basically took over the tradition from us, and like all the hacker houses since that one have all been her creation. And, you know, we kind of all became good friends during that particular one where she got to sort of meet us for the first time.
And these hacker houses, there, it isn't like a competition or anything. It's just, there's no prize money at the end. It's just people in the Solana eco hacking and building their projects.
Well, I'd say it's changed a lot. So the 2020, like our hacker houses were a bit different. I don't know if they're entirely like now. I haven't been to, I don't think I've been to a full one in like 6 months, but my understanding is, so the original design of them was more engineering focused, and it was like you come, you sit, you hang out with other engineers, and it's kind of like you do work, but around other people. And it's this sense of community because the Solana community is small. And I think it worked for what it was at that slice of time because, you know, at the time, Solana was so much smaller than Ethereum. You know, and these people wanted a sense of community. And also it was just after COVID, as you mentioned. So like people wanted this sense of togetherness, right? I think what they've evolved towards now is they feel more like the ones I have been to, like, I think I was like in a Austin one 6 months ago. It feels more like a pop-up conference now. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's more welcoming of like now Solana isn't just like Solana used to be mostly like when you went to a Solana conference, it felt like the old days, the Solana conference was, I feel like, you know, it was very non-engineer focused. What the hacker houses added was this engineer area. You know, now it's kind of like, you know, the hacker houses, now they act as a separate vehicle to have a pop-up conference that effectively sort of adds support for all types of people. Like they're like an auxiliary conference. Like if you go to a normal Solana conference now, like Breakpoint, you have really good support, I feel like, for both engineers and non-engineers, you know, whereas like, you know, the older Breakpoints, it was tough as I remember, like I'd be walking around Breakpoint and there was no place to really sit down with a laptop. Mm-hmm. You know, it just wasn't a thing back then. And I think it was probably due to COVID. You know, it was just, they didn't put up a lot of seats that you could sit at because like there were these COVID protocols. So Hacker House was sort of that place where you could access that kind of thing. Now you have Breakpoint, which is this big place, but they still have areas for engineers. And Hacker House is like, okay, hey, Breakpoint happens once a year, but multiple times a year, you can go to these smaller cities. And for like 2 days, you can have a pop-up conference where you have technical talks, non-technical talks. And you have like a sitting area where whether you're an engineer or not, you can sort of do work or socially interact. So it's sort of like evolved into this, I feel like a kind of a halfway house. It's kind of like a Soho house, I think, for Solana. Yeah. I feel like I'm not describing it well, but it's like, it's not what it was. It's evolved with the times and the needs, I think, of the community.
Got it. It's a pop-up event. It's a pop-up event. That evolves with the times, whether it's like engineer. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is like, again, say it's evolved. And like, that's sort of what Ellie does. It's like, she listens, she puts her ear to the ground and is listening to how the environment's changing. And it's like, it's not post COVID anymore. And also because she has control over the bigger events, she can change the bigger events to match, like to put in maybe what is not missing, like not there. And also it's not just after a pandemic, which like when you have a pandemic, it changes, you know,
it changes a lot of things.
Like, you know, like I remember you were there. It was a fucking crazy time.
You mentioned at the first Hacker House that you had, Metaplex came through, which was, I thought you co-founded it, but I guess, or you were like part of it early on. Can you give a bit about the story of Metaplex, like, how'd you get involved in it? And like, how did it become the NFT standard of Solana?
Oh yeah. So that was like my first 2 weeks at work. You know, Tolly and Raj, two of the co-founders at Solana, Foundation Labs. I always mix up which ones they were the co-founders of, but, yeah, I think their original vision was that Solana would be a DeFi chain versus Ethereum's sort of NFT focus, you know, because Solana was so just blazingly fast. But when they saw that, and it's funny because that they may still ultimately be right, because, you know, like the DeFi Summer 2.0, I think, is coming. But, you know, at the time, while they were focusing very hard on DeFi, you know, Ethereum NFT summer was heating up in 2021, as you remember. There were like a couple of experiments going on. Like basically you could make a token with the decimals of zero on Solana and then sort of off chain say like, hey, if you have this token in your wallet, it's represented by this image. Like some shit like that. Like you can go to this website and see what's this token is. So like some really cheap gimmicks for NFT standards. And they were looking at this and saying like, this is sad. NFTs are heating up. We should have something. So, you know, in a really astute move, I think I have to credit it to Raj. I don't know who actually had the idea. It could have been Raj. It could have been Anatoly. I don't know. I was too far down the food chain. They said to Bartosz and myself, they're like, hey, you guys are new. You just started. Can you go build us a prototype of an NFT framework, like an NFT standard? You know, can you just build us something in 2 weeks? See what it looks like. And so, you know, for 2 weeks we worked, and we came up with this program called Token Metadata, which I think is still in use today. And it was very simple. Basically, let you decorate a token mint account on Solana, and that's the old style mint, not Token 22, a token mint account with a new account called Token Metadata that would give it a URL, you know, royalties, creators, some other fun stuff, that would essentially, you know, make that token into an NFT, provided it met some, you know, requirements. Like you could also do fun stuff like master editions, and you could mint, you know, limited editions from the master editions and some other cool shit. But this was like a 2-week hackathon kind of thing. And, they were like, well, that's great. And then they were like, by the way, you know, we had this agreement with Blau, which is an artist, or not Blau, it was this other artist, but they're like, this other artist wants this Blau style auction built and shipped for their, I think it was like a concert, and another couple of weeks, and a Blau style auction is like this really crazy style auction where like the first, like there's like, you know, 8 prizes and the first person gets the first edition of all 8 prizes and the second winner gets the like second edition of all 8 prizes. And like, and by the time you get to the 5th winner, he only gets like the first, he gets like the last, I think he gets like the first, he gets like the 5th edition of the first 4 prizes or something like that. Like it's a really crazy set of rules. And they were like, this is great. We need to build this auction system. And this auction system, by the way, was not easy to build, but their thesis was that it would be very popular and that by having it, we'd be able to beat Ethereum. And they were like, okay, let's do this in another couple of weeks and we'll watch with both the metadata system and the auction system. And also we should build a token vaulting system, which is kind of this way of, locking up tokens in an escrow. And so it was like a bunch of different stuff that we had to build, and it kind of made up the initial standard. And just so you know, basically none of this, almost none of this was ultimately like, was used after the first 6 months. After the first 6 months, the only thing I ever got used was token metadata. But yeah, they wanted all this stuff. And the only saving grace that saved us here was the lawyers looked at everyone and was like, look, you know, it's going to take much more than 2 weeks to set up the, you know, the Metaplex entity, because ultimately, we had all decided that Solana Foundation is very big on decentralization. We didn't want to own the standard. Like, we're all very happy to launch a standard, but, you know, Raj and Tolly had no interest in actually owning it because they didn't want to, like, on top of owning the Foundation is already pushing updates to the validator code and asking validators to update. You know, they didn't want to also like, you know, be pushing updates to this Metaplex standard too. It's just like, it's not a good look. They actually, despite all the shit that they get on Twitter from the Ethereum people, are actually incredible proponents for decentralization. This is why they, you know, are so excited that Jump is working on the second validator, the Fire Dancer thing, because it further decentralizes things. So in that same vein, they wanted the lawyers to set up a whole separate company called Metaplex that would take this software from Bartosz and I, hire new engineers after running a funding round, and then have them take it over. And the lawyers were like, look, we can do all this instead of just launching it yourself, but it's going to take like another 6 weeks. But that was a saving grace for me because I needed like 6 weeks to actually finish the damn thing. So it sort of was like a sprinting race. The next like 6 weeks of my life, I think they were probably the worst 6 weeks of my life. Like I built all of this stuff with Bartosz. It was crazy. I have never worked so hard in my life to produce all of this software. I mean, like it was a full auction suite. So you could do like any different kind of auction you wanted for an NFT. And it used all the different software. And we built like a full website so anyone could build their own website for auctions. So they could all have their own custom auction website. Cause our idea was people want to make their own like special website and then auction code on it, like auction NFTs on it. And we had no idea that it was going to be a thing where people wanted to sell 10,000 NFTs at a time. We thought it was going to be like art. So this whole thing was engineered around art. And we built this special type of auction that's called a Blau style auction, which I still don't remember the rules of. I only understood them back then because it was 3 years ago and it's been too long. And it was crazy, but it all worked. And 6 weeks later, we launched at Miami, Bitcoin Miami. I still remember it. It was crazy. We launched at like 3 a.m. and it just barely worked. We still have pictures from the event. Like it was me, Bartosz, Stephen Hess, who's the CEO of Metaplex now. We're all standing at the party and they had like pictures of the Metaplex logo on the wall. And Stephen Hess had gotten us like jackets with the original logo and the original hat I still have in my closet. And it was a crazy time. And then, yeah, we launched the company and hired some engineers for it. They did a round, raised a bunch of money, hired engineers. I trained them in how to use the software. And then, and yeah, they started adding stuff. And then over the next few months, I continued to build stuff for Metaplex. But every time I built stuff, I would just pass the license over to them. And then they would, you know, start maintaining it. And then, you know, eventually they started building their own things. But like importantly, and this has always been a theme that you'll see from Solana Foundation, is that they do, you know, like I said, going back to the decentralization, you do need people that believe in it. They are very big on, I guess you could say, smearing the responsibility around. So Metaplex exists solely so that, you know, like there's a node of responsibility that isn't Solana Foundation worrying about a key piece of infrastructure, that being, you know, NFTs.
It's interesting because on Ethereum, you have ERC-721, ERC-1155, and that was like proposed in the whole EIP process. So it's not like there's a company maintaining it. It's more so like the Ethereum protocol is maintaining it. Meanwhile, at Solana, it takes a different approach where it's like, okay, you guys basically built out this standard, but then gave it to a private organization to basically maintain.
Well, so it's an interesting point you make. And I think in a perfect world, EIPs are better. Because, you know, in a perfect world, everyone cares and is taking the time to review the protocols and, you know, and is voting on these things and reviewing the code and pushing code. But like, realistically, how many guys do you know that have jobs who are, how many people both like are qualified to review an EIP and the associated code, have the time and wherewithal to do it, and are interested in doing it? Like how many people on the planet, like, are we talking about here? Like, is it 500? Yeah. Is it 50? Like, it differs for each EIP, right? Like that's sort of like what we're talking about here is kind of a version of socialism. There is a lack of incentive for any single person on the planet to go and care about this, except for maybe the people, you could argue the people who work under the software that sort of sits like maybe on top of the EIPs, like they would care and they'll go comment on it. But it's a system that scares me because there's no one that is sort of directly responsible for the EIP. And so like, I agree that like in principle, it looks like a better system. But what I like about having companies that are directly responsible for the protocol is that yes, while it's centralized in the sense that they control the code, there's literally some assholes that are paid to use the thing, which is great. And so that means like there's at least like some guys that like to just know how this thing works, and this is all they do every day.
Yeah.
And so you can argue like, yeah, they may be corrupt. And that I think is a fair argument to make. Like, we could talk about that, but at least they're looking at it every day.
At least they care.
Yeah, at least they care to some extent. And like, you could set up the company differently. Like, you could, you know, you could argue like, okay, the engineers could work there. Like, you could set up a company that is controlled by a DAO, maybe. So the DAO could, you know, vote on things, like what they want to do at a strategic level, but then the tactics are handled by the employees. But I don't like it when you have the thing so sort of disconnected. But the other reason that it's mostly controlled by a company, and this is sort of Solana focus, is that Solana is a namespace-based programming language, like programming setup. Like the way that NFTs work is like it's only an NFT if you have this program, if you're looking at this program and this program's namespace of accounts. And so someone has to control that program. Whoever controls that program essentially is the company. Therefore, the company must exist. This concept of proposals doesn't make any sense. And so it doesn't happen. Whereas Ethereum is an interface-based system where it's like you vote on the interface, it passes. People have to meet this interface if they want to use it. You know, there's been talk on Solana about moving to an interface system, but no one's built a system that works well enough yet. They may in the future. I would not be surprised if they did. I do know that Metaplex has tried to get people to vote on their proposals, but this has actually been an exercise in proving me right, because they create these, they try to get people to create proposals. People either don't create them, or Metaplex themselves will create them, and people just don't read them or vote on them. Like, it's because it's like the uninformed voter problem.
Yeah, if you chunk up to what you're saying, it's not just a Metaplex problem. It's a problem with all DAOs. It's a problem with DAOs. Everything in crypto.
Where DAOs fucking suck.
Yeah.
DAOs suck. I don't like them very much. Like, there's this guy, Blockiosaurus, on Twitter. I have fought with him a lot. I think he called me like a piece of shit at one point, even. and he's a Metaplex developer. I think I even hired him like years ago. And but, you know, like, as much as we may disagree, you know, on many things, you know, he works at Metaplex, and he gives so much of a shit about the protocol. Like, I would much rather have him making decisions about what to do next than 100 DAO voters. Is it an imperfect solution? Yeah. But like, the thing is, like, and this is what I think people don't realize about engineering, is like, so much of engineering just comes down to like a couple of guys sitting around a computer screen, just being like putting their finger to the wind, just being like, yeah, it seems like the right solution. And then the rest of the world is forever changed. That's basically it's like human evolution kind of just happens.
Yeah. And then if you deal with something like 100 or 1,000 DAO voters arguing over what decision to make on a specific code direction, or even just code direction, any direction, maybe a strategic direction or something like that, then that's when you get into problems. Like, an example that just came into my head was in 2021, I believe it was at the ECC. This was peak sushi. This is when sushi was on top of the world. They announced Bento Box. And at the time, they were looking to raise a round. And Xerox Maki put a proposal to like, oh, let's like sell tokens OTC to like Dragonfly and a bunch of other investors, which in hindsight was the absolute right thing to do. But the community came into an uproar about it. There's Twitter spaces. They're like, why are we doing this? Like, you know, the token's worth more than that. There was like a huge fuss about it, and it got voted down. I don't know if it even went to a proposal, but that was like the last time Sushi had that said, I think it was like either 10 or 20 bucks or something. It was a very desirable price, and all the attention was on Sushi. But since then, like at that point, like it was just downhill from Sushi. Xerox Maki left. There's a bunch of organization dysfunction.
That's the thing to remember. People like to talk about America being a democracy, but it's not a democracy. It's a republic.
Yeah.
And it's actually a republic of the states, not of the people.
Yeah.
Democracy is actually fucking horrible. You know, because you end up with situations like this. Like, you need a vote of people to, but that's an input into a much more, you know, tailored system. You need representative government. I think DAOs are missing that. Some of them do have the concept of councils. Like, I had, when I built the first DAO system, it was one of the things I did was I built the first, I guess you'd call it, draft of governance system in Solana. I built this idea of a council that could be voted in. And basically council votes can override and create their own proposals. But like, you need to be able to vote in smarter people than you, for lack of a better word. But like, you know, the masses, like people, when they vote in mass, I think this is my own personal opinion, they vote like idiots and are often unqualified to make votes. And this includes me. Like, I'm not qualified probably to vote on a lot of different issues. But I am probably qualified to vote on a couple of issues. But you know, this is why you elect different representatives. This is why the president has a cabinet, right? So, you know, I think one thing that's missing from crypto is the idea of representative government. We're so obsessed with mass democracy, and stake weighted democracy that I think it's killing us. And I think detriment. You could,
yeah,
yeah, it's a detriment. I think it's possible to actually come up with a version like a combination of like the Metaplex direct, like as you call it, like authoritarian engineering style of government and like mass democracy, you know, a DAO style government where you get some representatives in between that sort of act like board members to the corporation. Yeah. And then the corporation itself that executes on the directives of the board, because that's how companies work. Like I am on the board of multiple companies and I act as like a voice of the investors, right?
Yeah.
Or an advisor. But if I were elected by a DAO, I could act as a voice of the DAO members for a term.
On the engineers.
Yeah. As a check. And the board members is elected with, you know, in the way that it works with corporate laws, like the board member has a fiduciary duty to act in the interests of the, you know, the members that put them in place. So the investors in that instance. So I guess if you change the bylaws to cover DAO members, you'd have to, I guess, enumerate what issues that they care about when they elected you so that like you act within those issues. But I think that there's something there where if you elect three representatives and they act as the board of like, let's say Metaplex, then you wouldn't have to have all these proposals or any like things slowing it down. It's just like you have a board meeting once a month and it's like, these are the things we're working on. And the CEO just goes and CEOs the fuck out of it. And
it's and funny like, how we're just figuring, we're just relearning all this shit now. It's just like, oh, like there's a reason why corporations are structured the way they are. They're like hundreds of years of corporate evolution. And now with DAOs, it's like, okay, like let's relearn these lessons.
I mean, look, I think the single greatest thing that the Dutch ever invented was the corporation.
Yeah.
Dutch East India Company. They invented that. It was the beginning of modern capitalism. And the creation of the greatest amount of wealth that the world has ever seen started at that point in time. Was when they invented the corporation so that shareholders could pool their resources to create massive endeavors with shared risk. That is what corporations are. And we're essentially not doing it in crypto because of this obsession with making sure that every little voter with every little token gets every little piece of like voice all the fucking time so that no one can hear themselves think.
Yeah. Like,
that's DAOs.
Yeah.
And yeah. So that's my frustration with that.
Yeah, no, I've been in DAOs and I've experienced the good and the bad with them and just having like people like have to like micromanage. It's like the worst form of micromanaging because it's one thing to be micromanaged by one person, but to be micromanaged by a group of people, most who are unqualified or don't, they may be qualified, but they may not have all the information to make the right decision because it's impossible to keep track of. Yeah.
Yeah, they're faceless.
It's baseless. Yeah. So.
Well, no, they have their faces. They don't have to do it in person. Even shareholders in the Dutch East India Company had to show up to a shareholder meeting with a stock certificate, which changes the game.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but like, this is why executives are important, you know, board members, appointed executives, you know, different layers of representatives in a company make it function. Like the executives should be separate from the, you know, appointed board members who are separate from the massive shareholders. This is how it should be.
And everyone is just a check on each other.
Yep. Yeah.
And moving on a bit. So you helped co-found Metaplex, basically was the foundation for that. You're at Solana Labs as an engineer for a bit. When did you and Bartosz go on to start BNJ Studios? What is BNJ Studios and what are you guys working on there?
I would say about 2 years into Solana Labs, we
wanted you to decentralize more.
Yeah. Well, we had started a lot of stuff we had been kickstarting Bartosz has written a lot of the original pieces of software that inform the current DeFi today. Like he basically provided a lot of, I guess you call it the example code for a lot of the DeFi code that exists today, that he did in his first, I'd say year at Solana. And then I wrote a lot of the sort of a lot of the like, you know, NFT contracts that Metaplex got in its first year. Right. So we both contributed a lot of, I guess you'd call it like contract code. And we were very good at kickstarting contracts. You know, like Bartosz was really helpful to the Wormhole team. And its beginning days, I was helpful to the Metaplex team in the beginning days. So we were prolific in producing code and assisting teams and getting teams off the ground. That was our job. Like, that was what we were supposed to do, is to help teams get off the ground. So after a couple, like, I think a year and a half, a couple of years, you know, we decided to see if we could sort of make this into a systematic kind of factory setting. We spun up a company called D&J Studios, which is kind of a sister company to our little capital group that we have, where we just invest 50-50 in companies. And it is kind of, I call it like a, it's like a VC with, you know, with arms. Like, we, you know, so we'll like, you know, we basically will, if we have an idea, we will, you know, take that idea. Sometimes we'll build some of it ourselves. Sometimes we'll recruit people to like into the company, like B&J Studios, and, you know, retain them as employees or contractors to help, you know, work out the idea. It's sort of like a star coalescing from gas. It will, you know, slowly form and start heating up, and you know, we'll keep track of the expenditures of each idea. Like, the goal is to generally spend around $400,000 or less inside the company, sort of proving out the idea. And then if it sort of reaches a point where it's naturally what I would call fundable, then we spin it out as a new company. And whatever remains of that 400,000 is part of the first fundraise. And, you know, the new CEO of that company that, you know, we will presumably have found and hired by that point will go out and raise for that company with the full team. And it becomes a new B&J Studios company. The most recent team like this would be Elements, that fully raised, I think, in June of this year, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sort of the life cycle. The top co runs pretty lean. Like, it costs very little to run. It tends to just only spike when we have like active people inside that are, you know, building. Mm-hmm. And generally what determines when we're doing that is when, you know, like, we either have an idea or someone comes to us with an interesting idea that is worth building around. So yeah, it's sort of like an active incubator, or like, you know, a VC that does its own, you know, building. Venture studio is the word that we like to use.
And are you leading Elements? Are you the CEO of Elements?
No, that would be O'Day. O'Day okay. MR, who's a very cool guy that is, I think, worth an interview on his own. Very entertaining guy.
Yeah. And so Elements is the RWA exchange?
Yes. It just is oil and gas right now.
Oil and gas. Okay.
Yeah. It does Reg D offerings of tokenized oil and gas.
Oh, okay. So it's like actual Reg D. Okay. Got it.
Yep.
We had on Ostium a few months ago. Have you heard of Ostium?
I have not.
Okay. So they're an RWA perp exchange on Arbitrum that has synthetic RWA. So they have oil, they have copper, they have soybeans, they have like a bunch. They have, if you name a commodity, they probably have it. And they were quite interesting. I feel like something like Ostium and like these RWA exchanges are something that can get people that aren't traditionally in crypto, maybe more in TradFi, on chain, especially if the UX and UI is there. So
I agree. Yeah. I think they're part of this next wave. I think the meme coins are done for the moment, but I think these new products are the future.
What are your thoughts on the whole Solana meme coin cycle that just happened? It honestly was quite reminiscent of what ICOs did on Ethereum in 2017, when it, like, a bunch of speculation happened and it brought a bunch of attention, both positive and negative. I feel like with the meme coins, it was like very specific to Solana and degen culture on there, because there's just so much. Solana's just so much easier to use because it's easier to use, you get like a certain type of speculator on there compared to like Ethereum, where it had like a different type of speculator.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I think about this a lot. I think, I think, you know, some of it was to some extent product development. It's weird because technically meme coins have existed before, right? Like, if Samo and Bonk came out, you know, far, long before anything else did. So there were meme coins, but you know, to some extent, people made it easier to launch new meme coins. But the question is chicken and egg, right? Like, did people make it easier to launch new meme coins, thus kickstarting the trend? Like, this is Candy Machine. Candy Machine made it easier to launch the NFTs, you know, or were the NFTs coming anyway and Candy Machine was just there? And you could ask the same thing about the did Pump Pop Fun come first, or was Pump Pop Fun, you know, just a facilitator of something that was going to happen anyway? So you could argue on the one hand, it's the tools that made it happen, right? Like, but that seems like too simple of an explanation to me. I like to look for macroeconomic indicators. And I think, really looking at it, I think, you know, we started going into like sort of a shitty sideways bull at the beginning of the year, you know, like it was like a crab, you know, like we had like a really nice, I don't know, like, what was it like last year in like November, October, we had like a nice rise in Solana, like prices across the board. But I remember Solana like went like right up into the hundreds and then just kind of stayed there. And I had to bring up the graph to remember it exactly, but like Solana, everything kind of had like a nice good time up until like February of this year, March of this year, right? And I don't remember when the meme coin thing really took off, but I remember it being around January or February of this year. That was when it like kind of went like lit its ass on fire, right? So if I'm speaking out of my ass here, but I can kind of roughly time in my mind the beginning of the crab market with sort of roughly the beginning of the meme coin craze. So like in my internal logic is saying, okay, maybe all that upwards energy kind of went into the meme coins and causing the general market to go sideways. And like, so it's like, why, well, why is that? Because what's interesting actually is that the actual stock market continued to go up all throughout the year. And how do I know this? It's because I live off of my stock market earnings. And, and I actually sold some throughout the year, and partway through the year, there was the same price as it was. Like I had the same amount of money in my stock market, like index fund at the beginning of the year as I did midway through the year, meaning it went up and I sold that amount. So like you know, it had actually gone up. And I had made money and I just sold the difference. So in crypto, what I think happened was when we entered that crab, it was because it was all being shunted into meme coins. Question is, why is it being shunted into meme coins? What happened? Why did people decide that meme coins were hot and now they're not? I think what happened was, you know, interest rates were high. They were high because the Fed is trying to kill inflation. But people began to perceive that interest rates are going to be low, and in the and as a forward action of the perceiving impending cuts, they are moving money out of the gambling coins back into, I guess you could say, better investments. Like people will gamble when there's nothing better to do. I guess that's sort of what I'm thinking. Like I know where the money went. It went out of like there was a bull market coming because I think they were expecting cuts that didn't happen. So they went into meme coins. Now they're expecting cuts, so they pulled out. But now it's still kind of shitty. So it's like, questions, where did the money go? I guess it's just sitting maybe on the sidelines. Maybe they lost it. Well, but someone gained it. So it's like, where is that money at? Maybe it's sitting on the sidelines. This is like the best I've been able to figure out is like, I think it's sitting on the sidelines. Someone won that money. I think it's preparing to be deployed, and my guess is it's going to be deployed. And this is only on the crypto side. I think they're preparing to deploy it in the majors, you know, shortly, you know, once the interest rates drop, or maybe they've already deployed it at these low rates. Because, you know, once interest rates drop, you know, fractional reserve lending happens, more money is created, floods into the crypto markets. Then you can, you know, everything goes up. Those people can then make a profit. So this is, again, I'm like talking out of my ass here using the MBA econ class I had like 5 years ago, just trying to reason through what happened. But yeah, to answer your question, why did meme coins happen? I think people were expecting interest rate cuts. They didn't happen. They got bored. they went to meme coins.
I feel like they would have went to meme coins whether the cuts happened or not.
It's possible. That's the thing. But then the question I would ask you is, why didn't they do it earlier? Why didn't they do it when SAMO came out? Like, at any point in time, you could have had a meme coin craze. Like, even during the NFT period.
Must have to do with Pump.Fun. And I actually was early. I was the first person to interview Alon from Pump.Fun back in early March. And it's meme coins existed, but it didn't become as easy to deploy a meme coin than it was on like Pump.Fun. And I think from there, when it became easy to deploy, that's when you had all the energy. I kind of felt the same energy in DeFi summer of like something novel and new happened. But instead of it being DeFi, it was meme coins. And it was like very different in character. It was different in character because in DeFi, it was very hopeful. It was like, oh, wow, we can build better financial rails. Like, look at all the stuff we're building. Like, granted, it was like very degen and like probably the same amount of risk and gambling. But the way that it was coded was much more optimistic, it felt like. With meme coins, it was characterized by this financial nihilism. It was like, oh, like everything's a meme coin. Like, oh, like this is all just a gamble. Might as well put it in like so-and-so.
It may be. I guess the question is, because I always felt like the most of the value of the meme coins was lost before Pump.Fun came on the scene. Like, I lost like an absurd amount of money in Muay Thai. that was never a Pump.Fun coin. But I'm just trying to think, like, I guess the interesting thing is, like, where did the majority of the money get lost? Was it in Pump.Fun coins or non-Pump.Fun coins? And I guess that would answer the question, right? Like, if it was 80% Pump.Fun coins, then you're right. The tools thesis is correct. If it's not, then it maybe was something else. But I am curious. I would love to know, like, where, how it happened. Where did the money go?
I think it went primarily like a few places. One, it was just Pump.Fun just raking fees. I believe they have $100 million in cumulative fees. So good for them.
Good for them.
Second is, once people figured out Pump.Fun, you had all this infrastructure being built around it between like snipers and bots and like ways to make it seem like it was a CTO, but it wasn't like a community takeover. And I've like seen and like talked to people that like run these like different basically like bot sniper things, and they're really intricate operations. And so I think it went to the people that figured out how to play the Pump.Fun game, and like the game could only be run so many different times. Some people are like, they call themselves ruggers, like quite literally. And they just like, oh yeah, we'll like launch a coin and then we'll just like rug, and then there goes the money. And other people, it's like a lot more long term, and they're actually trying to like build a community. In order to do that properly, you need to like play the game with like the bots and snipers. And so I think like a lot of money just got, I think the game stopped when people just kept on losing money. And then when it becomes too PvP, that's when the music ends.
Makes sense. So like basically you think like $1 billion got removed through Pump.Fun, not necessarily directly, but through these bad actors. And and now that it's gone, it's just, there's nothing left. These people are poor now.
I would say like my,
I think it's a valid thesis.
That's a valid thesis
as to why it ended, not why it necessarily began.
Yeah.
But I will agree with you as to that is why it ended.
And I think like one of my, this leads to kind of one of my criticisms of Solana, is that it can feel too PvP at times, that it's just like, because honestly, it's so fast and the velocity of money is like so much faster. And kind of, I feel like one thing I noticed is like the cultures of like between Solana and Ethereum, where like Ethereum's kind of like more of this like open building, like, you know, you have these different protocols and standards. And it seems, it feels more like, let's grow the pie together. Meanwhile, and I'm not saying like one way is like right and wrong, like each way has its advantages and disadvantages. Meanwhile, with Solana, I feel like it's much more competitive by nature, and like, that's fine. But like what comes with it is like, you know, if it's too competitive and it's too cutthroat, then if someone's a loser, then it kind of like makes these like feedback loops a bit faster, whether it's like Pump.Fun or something else.
Could you explain to me an MEV sandwich attack?
What?
Could you explain to me what an MEV sandwich attack is?
Fair, fair. The MEV people. I was more talking about like the protocols themselves. I didn't include.
So not those people, just these people. But in general, as long as you don't include those people in Ethereum, these other people in Ethereum are perfectly fine individuals.
Yeah. Okay. Fair. Fair. The MEV people are like the most people. Like they're basically the high frequency traders. I view them as like the high frequency traders of Ethereum, and they're just like they're taking advantage of the architecture, like the way Ethereum is designed. Ah, I'm more like
sounds very familiar to what you just said about the Solana people.
Yeah. You got me. It's funny because like in my like bias, my personal bias, I view MEV as like a whole separate category of like people.
It was an engineering decision that actually I don't have a problem with. It's just what we're really talking about is people respond to incentives. It's just like the DAO thing. People respond to incentives. It's just pump that fund. They built a system of incentives, and then people are dicks. They'll do whatever it takes to make money. Like people are in this system, they're rational actors.
Yes.
More or less. I mean, like there are cases where people are irrational actors, which are very interesting, but not in this one.
Yeah.
And it's just, like this, I don't have a problem with the MEV sandwich thing. Cause it's like you said, it's like an artifact of the system. But I am sorry that you had a bad customer experience with Solana. I will forward your complaint along.
No. I've had a great time on Solana. This is more just my observations. I'm a huge fan of all the sniping. I mean, not the sniping. Fuck the Telegram bots. I mean, like from like a user experience perspective, maybe not from like a decentralization perspective, but for a while, like the only way I could interact with Solana if I use like BonkBot. And I'm just like, wow, this is so easy to use. And
the Bonk team is amazing. I know a couple of them, but
I do
the
too.
Telegram bots. I'm generally very bullish on Tan as well. I have a nice little cache of Tan.
Yeah.
So I think that whole network is going to do very well in the future.
Yeah, no, but it's funny. The first time I used Solana was actually to mint Noah's NFTs.
Noah's NFTs. Are you talking about my brother's NFTs?
No. The Rave 3.
I have no idea what that is.
I was with him in the office with you. Jitoshi.
I'm sorry, it's been a long time.
Okay, my friend's NFTs. It was my first to mint his NFTs. But yeah, no, I've had like I did have like the aha moment, like going back to the beginning of the interview, when you talk about like user experience, like let's be real, like using Solana is a lot smoother than using traditional Ethereum. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess this is why like this is like gained traction. And like to kind of like sum up the interview, it's like not just the user experience, but also what's been developing is the whole builder experience around like dev tooling and developer tooling and everything in that regard. And so different priorities between Ethereum Eco and Solana Eco.
You know what would work to solve the L2 problem for Ethereum is for all of the L2 founders to get together in a room and fight to the death.
Yeah.
And whichever one wins gets to shut down all the other L2s and move all of the money and data and contracts to their L2. And then that L2 becomes the only L2 for Ethereum. And it presumably will be better architected than Ethereum because most of these L2s, they've made better decisions than Ethereum has because they have the benefit of hindsight, just like Solana has. And gradually over time, now there's only one L2 on Ethereum. Everyone just agrees we're not making L2s anymore, you know, because there's only one, there's one L2 to rule them all. And no one's allowed to deploy any contracts to Ethereum. And just gradually everyone sort of moves from the Ethereum layer to the L2 layer, whatever one that might be. It could be Polygon, could be Arbitrum, could be Optimism. Whatever guy wins the fight to the death. You know, and then that becomes the new Ethereum. And if it's built better, then, you know, and everyone just believes that, you know, because the two layers are connected, that the money is linked and everything's fine. It's good. And then like 30 years from now, you can actually just delete the Ethereum layer, because actually having the bridge doesn't even matter, because like they're one-to-one. And then you've got a new Ethereum, and it just works better, works as good or as well as Solana.
So I mean, it's just really, like a 30-year project to like transfer, basically a migration.
Yeah, it could be a 10-year project, and I'm kidding about the fight to the death. You really should just choose the best one, but like I actually don't know of a better way to get all these founders to agree to essentially give up their wealth and power. But you know, you get the idea, right? It's like if you just had one L2 to rule them all, and you got rid of all the other ones, then you could effectively say like, this is the new Ethereum. Everyone's moving here. It has better. It's a better execution layer. It you know, one of these things is actually better. And that is the way you solve the problem, because they are actually essentially a copy of Ethereum at the end of the day. They're EVM compatible. They have separate data, separate compute, you know, separate tokens. You just move the whole thing.
Yeah.
You treat it like an engineer would treat like a database migration. And like that would solve your problem. And then Ethereum would live to fight another day. But, you know, Ethereum's like the Holy Roman Empire. It is neither Holy Roman nor an empire.
That's actually a really good comparison.
So and you know what happened to that, right? It's definitely not.
It lasted a really long time.
It lasted over 800 years, but all it takes is one Napoleon to fuck it right up.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I don't think it's not going to happen.
This actually leads to my last two questions. I'll ask them in one. Right now, we have all these new L1s that are allegedly coming out soon. We have, you know, Bearchain, Monad, Mega ETH, and they all have their different value prop. And it's funny. It's like what you were saying before. It's like, oh, if only in hindsight Ethereum knew these things, it could be architected in this way. And these L1s are basically like that, whether it's like Monad, parallelization, Mega ETH with what they're doing with their nodes. Bearchain's a bit different because they focus more on the DeFi side with proof of liquidity. But all these different chains are coming out. And what I was going to ask is like, what are your thoughts on these different L1s? And do you think any of them pose a threat to Solana? Or do you think there's a different threat to Solana?
I don't know enough about any of those chains specifically to know if they pose a threat to Solana. So I'll admit my own, I guess, bias and limitation there. I do know that, like, for instance, I actually looked in the Bearchain after we talked about it.
Yeah.
So I looked into this weird proof of liquidity concept. I didn't quite understand it. Actually, as I was reading the proof of liquidity concept of Bearchain, the more I read, the less I trusted them, which was interesting. It was kind of like when I was reading about, like 2 months ago or 3 months ago, someone was saying like, hey, you should read about Merlin Chain. It's the best new Bitcoin layer too. And I read all about that. And I even went to their booth in Hong Kong, and I just came away feeling slimy. And then 3 weeks later, it turned out that they were stealing, minting extra Bitcoin on their chain, Bitcoin layer too. So I had that same sort of feeling about Bearchain, but not to say that they're the same. I actually just had that same sort of, as an engineer, when I don't quite understand what's going on, it could be I'm an idiot, or it could be that you're not telling me something.
the Flywheel podcast of Bearchain in your research?
I did not. I didn't, because you didn't send it to me, but I should probably listen to it. But I was reading their Twitter feed, and I was like, this just seems very Ponzi-ish. And I didn't like it. But with Monad, all I know about it, besides the fact that I know Keone and know that he's just amazing quality, like leader and guy, and worked at Jump, and all the people that work there are also very high quality engineers, was that they're trying to build parallelized EVM, which I think is like EVM's greatest weakness, is that it's not parallelized. So that could be a risk. I don't know much about Mega ETH. When I think about EVM as a language, I remember I once tried to like take a look at the sort of JavaScripty style language that you have to write the contract in. I dislike it because when I'm writing a smart contract, I like exactitudes. Like when I'm messing with money, what I loved about Rust is that it is it's sort of, I mean, it's like C++ flavored. Like, you kind of have to use data types and you have to be very exact in what you're doing. And it forces you into a frame of thinking that, like, you can't, for lack of a better term, you can't fuck around like you fuck around in JavaScript. And so as a contract author, especially as a guy like me, I'm more of a hacker than I would say a computer engineer. It forced me to write better code. Like, I couldn't just have something that might, like, you couldn't write code that might throw an error in Rust. You have to write code that will catch that error and then do something else. Whereas, from what I understand, and I could be speaking out of my ass here because I've never finished and successfully submitted a contract in the Ethereum, like, weird JavaScript language that they've got, it looked like you could write code that had no explicit type, just like, you know, TypeScript or JavaScript, well, JavaScript anyway. TypeScript, you have the option, if you don't care about linting. You could sort of write code with no type. There wasn't any explicit, you know, forcing of like error handling. It just seemed a little more soft. So, you know, when I look at, like, as an engineer, which language I'd rather write in, I would still choose the Rust over EVM. So even if it were parallelized, I would still choose the Rust. That's neither here nor there. I guess I was just saying, like if you were to like say to me, like, hey, why would I choose Monad over Solana or Solana over Monad? Even if Monad were as fast, as an engineer, I would still choose the Rust. Though I could easily see an engineer, by the way, saying, hey, I don't want to take the time to learn Rust. I already know JavaScript pretty well. I know this language isn't exactly like JavaScript, but it looks similar syntactically to JavaScript. I'm going to use it.
Solidity, right?
Yeah, Solidity. Yeah, this weird Solidity. This, you know, it looks the same. It's dangerously not the same. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it's not the same. And that's dangerous. To me as a senior engineer, I think to myself, I don't know why it's not the same and that's dangerous. But if I were younger, I would look at it and I would say, hey, that looks the same. I don't have to learn that much extra. I just need to do this little thing. I'm just going to go, you know, hack it together yeah. and make it work because it looks very similar. I can ship it and my boss won't really know. It'll all work. Like, I'm going to move some money around. It's not a big deal. And then before you know it, you know, some really bad shit has happened. Yeah. And I think that's a risk. And this is why we have auditing firms, by the way, but I could see someone choosing EVM because of that. And I think that's weirdly both a strength and a weakness of it. Whereas a strength and a weakness of Solana is that you definitely have to learn another language. That language is definitely harder to learn, but it definitely forces you to think like I'm clearly in a different paradigm of thinking. I'm thinking about like dollars and cents and I need to actually be clear headed about what I'm doing. So they have like sort of different strengths and weaknesses. So like when you're comparing EVM chains to Solana, it's really actually apples and oranges. They have different strengths and weaknesses and different engineers will choose them for different reasons. But I have to be clear. I have a bias up front. I'm always going to choose the SVM language because like, I like that Rust forces me to be a better person because I am not a good person. Like I like what it does to me. You know, but there may be someone honestly, that's just a better person than me that just doesn't mind not having the limits on Solidity. Mm-hmm. And maybe also, I just don't know this. Solidity may have limits that I'm not aware of. I've never really written anything in Solidity. I've read some guides on it on the internet. I'm talking out of my ass on this one. So I could be completely wrong. This is just based on what I remember. So that's as for the, you know, as far as that, but as for like, you know, real competition for Solana, I think it's the same competition for all the chains. The real competition for all these chains actually, is weirdly, I'm not sure if you use like these like all-in-one apps like Line or WeChat that are coming out of Asia. They've existed for 10 fucking years. Like there are people in the middle of China that have never had an email address. All they have is a phone number and WeChat. And WeChat has everything inside of it. It has your shopping, has your Uber, it has like your payment system, it has your chat. You don't need email. It's everything. And these people don't give a shit about crypto. You know, a China banned crypto, they don't care. Like, that's the real competition. It's like basically Web 2 and the banks can together build software that is so good that crypto is unnecessary for 99% of the population by building a super app that is just better. And they already exist. They've existed for the last 10 years in China. They even make stuffed animals in the fucking, you know, like there are gift shops in Korea, in other places too, but I've only been to them in Korea, where you can buy line friends, like these little stuffed animals that my daughter loves, that are like these little stuffed animals representing like the characters from the Line chat app. But Line is actually so many other things in a chat app. And that's the real competition, is that these regulators who are trying to shut down crypto because it represents a deviation from the global financial norm, all get together, figure out how to work with these Web2 companies that really don't want crypto to survive because it means a risk to their own monopolies. If they figure out how to get together and work against crypto, I mean, that's the end. Like right now, they're not thinking about it, right? Like right now, it's just, you know, WeChat has an amazing app and makes billions of dollars, and the SEC and the CCP, you know, are both equally trying to cramp down on crypto. But if they ever work together united. Some way, yeah, united. Because like, you know, when I use these apps, I realize you don't need crypto in China. Like you just don't. Like, I mean, not unless you're trying to do something like get money out of China, which there's valid reasons for that. You know, but like if you're not trying to move money out of China, you're just trying to move money around inside of China, you're fine. You're trying to pay for a burger, you're fine. If you're in Vietnam and you just want to, you know, send money to your friend, you're fine, right? So like the only cases that crypto really has going for it in these Asian countries is like you're trying to move money around outside the bounds of normal regulations, which is already a risky case to be making. You know, the case we want to be making is like, you know, we're trying to lower interest rates, you know, because we can do things more efficiently. We're trying to, like, basically you're making an efficiency case. Like,
yeah.
We want to make your life cheaper, better, faster. And literally these apps are already making your life cheaper, better, faster. And if the governments are smart enough to realize that these apps can do that and they can kind of back them and then, you know, push them to the forefront, they can then simultaneously ban crypto and make it so that it never becomes a problem again.
So the threats aren't in crypto, they're outside of crypto. And if
we're not enemies.
Yeah.
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 Like
now, at the end of the day, we're all,
yeah.
Whether it's EVM, SCM, Solana, Ethereum, like we're all in this together in building this new system.
I see it as like if you're choosing to, like, for, as an engineer, I look at the choice between Monad and Solana as like, am I going to pick up like a Colt revolver or a Beretta to go fight? Like, it's like, to me, it's like, it's a tool to do the same thing. It's like what gun am I going to use? But I'm still using a gun, you know, but I'm fighting the same war just with different guns.
Yeah.
You know, like we're all in the fight together. I don't see them, like at the beginning, I saw them as competitors. Like I said, this is the fight. And in a sense, they are competitors, but like, the real competitor is actually weirdly enough, like I don't think that Google, for instance, has any real incentive to embrace crypto. You know, I think they have incentives to embrace AI, but I think embracing crypto doesn't help them any. And I don't think that obviously governments have any incentive to embrace crypto either. I think you could make some arguments for why they might. Or AWS, I think they actually have an incentive to work together to cancel crypto through some way. Like, I think they would prefer a world where crypto just didn't exist and they could freely censor whatever they wanted. You know, but in order to get away with that, they need to offer a superior product because we live in a capitalistic society. And the fact is that they offer a better product than we do. They have every right to cancel us strictly through market choice.
Yeah.
That's what terrifies me. I don't think they figured it out yet, though.
So it's not even just like top down with government and those industry leaders teaming up. It's like the consumer, the users themselves, they end up choosing Web2 at the end of the day because it's easier and better than that's it for the rest of us. And I feel like a big thing of this cycle is like focusing on you know, you hear about consumer crypto, consumer apps, like this and that. Like, that's like, I feel like that's the next phase of crypto. And like, however that may look, we will see.
Yeah. So I think that's exactly right. It's the consumer apps. People are choosing these super apps right now for everything. But you'll still see, for instance, I was in Turkey recently, and in the airport, the largest ads in the airport were for BTC Turk, which is a Turkish exchange.
Yep, I remember.
So the Turkish people, yeah, the Turkish people still see value in storing their wealth in BTC because the lira has a high inflation rate. So we, the crypto community, are still offering a thing of value to them there, a product that has value. And this is something that WeChat or, you know, Lime cannot offer them, which is a store of value that is better. So there are products that they can't beat us on yet. You know, but like this is something that they could, yeah. Right? Something to keep in mind. So that's the problem.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And on that note, that would be the last question of our formal interview. And before we go, I always ask this one question to our guests, which, and you kind of answered it already, but I'm wondering if you have a different answer, which is, who would you recommend as a guest? Who do you want to see on Flywheel?
Who would I want to see? Well, I think you get as much value out of having Ode Amar, the CEO of Elements, on as you would having Bartosz, the CEO of Cube. Cube is probably our best in senses and like biggest portfolio company. So Elements is our newest, and Cube is our biggest.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. So Bartosz Lipinski is the CEO of Cube, and Ode is the CEO of Elements.
Got it. We'll definitely keep in mind. And on that note, would you able to give your socials? Where can people find you? Where can people find B&J Studios?
Yeah. So B&J Studios, we never set up a website because we're just not really website people, but we are on Twitter. I'm not sure. I have to look up. I always mess up the Twitter. So my Twitter is redacted_J. Pretty easy to remember. The BJ Studios one is BJ_Studios. So pretty simple. And from there you can find links to everything else.
Got it. Go follow Jordan. Go follow B&J Studios. Jordan, thank you so much for coming on. We hope to see you again soon.
Yep. Have a good one.
Thank you, everybody, for watching this episode of Flywheel. We had on Jordan Prince, who is the co-founder of B&J Studios, who also went on to co-found Metaplex, early Solana dev. Lots of great insight. I really enjoyed that conversation. It was nice to hear a different perspective on the crypto space, especially someone who came in as an engineer, a doubter first and foremost, and someone who's mostly was in a world that's very separate from my own. So I hope everybody got a lot of great insight from that. If you want to see more Solana content, let me know in the comments below on YouTube or on Twitter, wherever you're watching this. If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you go ahead, give us a like, go ahead, subscribe, hit that bell button so you get all the latest updates. If you want to follow us on all our socials, please go ahead, do that at Flywheel DeFi on Twitter, TikTok, and Telegram. You can follow me on Twitter at DeFiDay22. And we'll see you next week. Peace. Everything said on this episode is not financial or tax advice. This channel is strictly for educational purposes and is not in investment advice or solicitation to buy or sell any assets or to make any financial decisions. This video is not tax advice whatsoever. Please talk to your accountant and do your own research.